These public lectures are not just for the passive consumer. They're supposed to stimulate thought and discussion. And so what we try and do with them is to have one academic and one public commentator. But there's an exception, and the exception is that Jeff Krosik, of course, is both a leading historian, has written widely on the petty bourgeoisie, but now also chief executive of the Arts and Humanities Research Board, and he will have a few comments, followed then by Madeleine Bunting, who writes for The Guardian and who's finishing a book on issues of work-life balance. Jeff.
I just start speaking, right. A book on issues of work-life balance is one that many of us in this room would like to read soon, I think. Well, first of all, can I say how pleased I am to have been asked, partly because, as Frank said, I'm a historian for whom questions of retailing and consumption have been a preoccupation for quite a long time. But even more so in my specific role now as Chief Executive of the Arts and Humanities Research Board, because Cultures of Consumption, the whole programme which Frank directs, is our first collaborative venture of this kind. A joint programme with the ESRC, our first collaborative venture with another research council. And it's a signal of things to come as we become a full research council in the next 18 months. But it's also a signal of the way in which the disciplinary divides can be artificial. The themes of the whole programme of Cultures of Consumption, in which we're jointly involved as two funders of research, the themes of the programme are as much humanities as they are social sciences. And indeed, many of the researchers who participate in the programme will probably be hard-pressed to decide where they fitted and would prefer not to choose, and quite rightly so. So the AHRB regards this partnership with the ESRC as very important. And I'm pleased, of course, to have been invited to make a few comments this evening, because it's a pleasure to respond to John's lecture. It's a wide-ranging and lucidly argued perspective, which I think provides a perfect opening to this series of lectures. And in the few minutes that I've got, I'm not going to try to engage with the lecture in detail, but just offer a few personal reflections. John is right, I think, to express anxiety about the use of the term consumer society. Like many such terms, it pretends to say so much more than it actually does. Industrial society and agrarian society were standard terms and have been standard terms used by historians, and their meaning is pretty opaque. But consumer society, or post-industrial society, or global society, are terms that are worse than opaque. Are they the inventions of historians? For consumer society, John suspected, or have historians simply colluded in their invention? I think historians have colluded because historians like labels. But non-historians especially like labels that sound as if they're historical. And the terms consumer society and post-industrial society both assume something earlier, which this has supplanted. And then the debate moves on, leaving the term unprobed. And John this evening has rightly invited us to probe it. Now, in focusing on the first major moment in the historical discussion, John persuasively drew the connection between Neil McKendrick's work on the 18th century consumer revolution and the Cold War economic analysis of Walt Rostow. I should have seen the connection earlier. As a fresh-faced first-year undergraduate arriving to do history at Cambridge, Neil McKendrick, as my director of studies, gave me Rostow's Stages of Economic Growth to read in my very first week. So one of the staggering 260,000 copies sold, John, is still on my bookshelves. But autobiographical reflections aside, let me confirm that for me, John has powerfully shown us how we must understand the historical study of consumption or of consumer society as the product of particular contemporary moments. Our current contemporary moment in the UK is an interesting one. The UK economy is being maintained not just by consumption, but by debt-driven consumption. And the Jeremiads who loom, focus on the fragility of that economic base for the current economic situation. They focus on the fragility of the economic base. They leave aside the moralizing about consumption or about debt as no more than occasional echoes of an older discourse, of older anxieties, as if we don't need to think about those things anymore. And those are the discourses and the anxieties that John has raised, the discourses of the 17th into the 18th century, the discourses of the later 19th century, in which there was real moral anxiety about what consumerism, consumption meant. Thus, what has happened, I think, in recent years, and in recent decades maybe, is that consumerism has been largely stripped of its moral dimension. The morality around consumption today is the morality of the market. In the UK, regulators put in place systems to allow consumers to operate as free and informed amoral agents in a competitive market, as if morality has nothing more to do with consumption. And the Directory Inquiries fiasco shows us that tragedy can be rewritten as farce. If morality enters into the debate about consumption these days, it's on the margins. Globalization and the struggle of José Bové in France, the fair trade movement seeking to press people to purchase selectively third world produce, and these link back to the shoppers' leagues of the turn of the 20th century in America and in France, which John referred to, the Ligue Sociale d'Acheteurs in France, which pressed consumers, middle-class female consumers, to buy essentially from shops which were stopped from producers who didn't use sweatshop labour, the moral power of the consumer. And of course, at the same time in the late 19th, early 20th century, consumer cooperative movements in Britain and in France presented the co-op as a moral force in consumption, which would create a different social order within the existing one. And at just the same time, Belgian Catholic economists, with a different political message, had a parallel vision for the moralising power of certain kinds of consumption. Now, this is one of the tensions, I think, that threads its way through John's illuminating lecture, through his typology and narrative, between the consumer as a market actor and the consumer as a moral agent. It's a tension in the discourses in the past, and it's a tension in the historical stories of the kind that he analyses. Think of the discourses on the department stores in the late 19th century. They were deemed by their critics to create false desires in susceptible bourgeois women. And they were attacked by French social Catholics for undermining the two great loves of French social Catholicism in one fell swoop, the family and small business. Yet even Émile Zola's novel, Au Bonheur des Dames, about a Paris department store, which was savage about the moral and social effects of the department store, shows Zola entranced against his will by its vibrant modernity. In just the same way that John has argued, historians of department stores repeat the same typologies. Did the department store liberate women, as one school argues, or manipulate and enslave them, as another does? Lisa Tiersten, in her impressive book on late 19th century France, shows something more subtle, the way in which condemnatory moral discourses about women's department store shopping gave way to a new discourse by the 1880s and 1890s, in which bourgeois women as consumers were incorporated into the Republican family ideal. By buying in department stores, by buying the right goods in department stores, they were serving the moral republic. Why does consumption have this power to be mobilized in so many ways by historians and contemporaries? I think it's presumably in part because of the sleight of hand that links consumption to consumerism. That was precisely one of John's arguments. And as he forcefully argued, the two are not necessarily connected. That's why I take particularly from this lecture an insight into why it has that power. It's because it's presented and used as if it were a free-floating force, not structurally connected to much else. It can therefore mean what you want it to mean. Today, in the past, and in today's discourses about the past, it can mean what you want it to mean. John's persuasive answer at the end of the lecture is effectively only connect. It is the connections to the economy and to politics that matter, as well as to the more fashionable issues of discourses and meanings. Because it is those connections, the economic and the political ones, which situate consumerism and make it relevant. John has shown, I think, in this lecture, persuasively why history is so important to the study of consumer society. But he's also shown how history can itself create the idea of a consumer society. And if that means that historians can have their cake and eat it, then why not? Consuming cake is not such a bad thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Frank, for asking me to contribute. I'm not an academic, and as a journalist, I come at this from a very different perspective, and that is a very reflective and quite self-critical one, really, about the extent to which the media has been a participant at all in considering exactly what is the role of consumption and consumerism. And I came to a very similar point as Geoffrey did about the kind of absence, really, of a dialogue, of a narrative, as to explain what it is that takes up so much of our time and our thought, which actually funds my job. I have to remember that, but for advertising, I wouldn't be getting a salary. So I'm a beneficiary of the consumer society. People who are buying newspapers are consuming a newspaper. But it seems that there's no public resonance, really, to the debates that John has been talking about today. And I find it very enlightening, very thought-provoking, his sort of speedy journey through 100 years or so of thinking about what consumerism means. And I wonder why it is that there isn't any kind of wider context. It's something about the split in this country, perhaps, between intellectual thought and the mass media. But given that we're talking about a subject which is of such great interest to so many people, it seems that my colleagues and I have served our readers quite badly in a reflective, critical understanding. And I then moved on to thinking, since I've been a commentator on The Guardian, which is now about 4 or 5 years, when has the debate about consumption, consumerism really emerged in a very striking form? And I'm going to press John, because I really want him to take on the issue of what's happened in the 90s and globalization, and how he would fit in to his various thoughts on this. Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, and the film Fight Club, both of which, interestingly, do you know the film Fight Club, John? You've not seen it.
No.
Both of them, they came out at about the same time, and they came out at about the time of Seattle WTO first sort of erupted onto people's consciousness. And I think both of them had an extraordinary resonance. Geoffrey was rather sort of dismissive and said that it was marginal, but to Guardian readers it was central. This was a major development. Certainly my email intray and my the letters, etc., coming in, was that here was a critique that really captured the imagination of particularly younger people. And I would be interested to know whether John thought that there was anything particularly new or interesting in Klein, or whether it was reinvigorating old critiques. It seems to me that what she put together was, or attempted to do, was consumption and production. And that's why she got pulled into a debate about globalization, and indeed has become one of the main spokespeople for a kind of critique of global capitalism and the power of corporations. So I very much would like John to comment on that, and I hope he can do that. There were two other thoughts, really, that cropped up about the sort of vacuum of the debate in the mass media. And one of them is that I think that there is still a very powerful moral narrative that sort of echoes, really, because it's lost its force. It has none of the institutions backing it up. The weight of religious thinking is no longer there. But I still think that there is a very clear reverberation, really, which I would identify as sort of self-loathing. We shop till we drop, and then we hate ourselves for it. Whatever our attitudes are about consumerism and consumer society, we're profoundly uncomfortable about it. And I think that's where John's insight I found very helpful about that sort of sense of nostalgia, really, for an era of more stable and coherent identities, where we imagine perhaps it wasn't so necessary to rely on objects as props for our sense of identity. I think there is another issue about which sort of drives the sense of discomfort is an anxiety about agency. And that's what was very clear in Fight Club, if anybody here saw it apart from myself, which is, are we manipulated? Is Vance Packard right? Or are we actually agents and are choosing what we consume? And I think that anxiety about agency is totally unresolved and feeds a sort of disillusionment, a sort of nihilism. It's sort of, we're all being manipulated. It's either Alistair Campbell or it's, Starbucks. It's all kind of a conspiracy against my independence, my freedom. And I think what's been very interesting in New Labour has been how that anxiety about agency and about the kind of agency that a consumer culture, a market economy provides us with has spilled over into political dialogue and political rhetoric. So what you will find amongst New Labour thinking is the language of consumerism that Blair specifically talks in his speeches about the right to choose. You must be able to choose your hospital, choose your school, and choice. And it's a concept which comes from our experience of consumer culture is seen as really a primary political virtue. Is this an infecting of the political debate? Is this a sort of, people will then argue, well, choice, if you've got a choice of two bad schools, what choice is that? And it seems to me that it's muddied the waters badly and is going to leave a very difficult legacy for politicians to try and unravel. Just what does choice in this political context mean? So, John, thank you very much for an extremely thought-provoking lecture, and I very much look forward to more comments that you might be able to help enlighten me further.